It's turkey time on this week's edition of Louisiana Eats. Roasting expert Molly Stevens shares some good advice.
I love to roast seafood, and I roast shrimp, I roast oysters, anything. It's similar to grilling in terms of the results you get. You can get these brown, caramelized exteriors and crispy end bits and tender inside. So I really encourage people, even if it's not kind of your tradition to roast it, it's sure a great way to prepare seafood.
Then we'll hear what Thanksgiving might have been like for the pilgrims if they'd landed in Louisiana.
The next course was a beautiful fish dish, the old-fashioned cocktail. So it's a Meunier sauce that we make with all the components of the old-fashioned bourbon cocktail.
Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Coming up next, but first, the news.
Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. It's turkey time on this week's show. Cooking teacher and award-winning author Molly Stevens joins us to debate the best methods of roasting. But when it comes to turkeys, roasting is never an activity that I advocate. I'm all about frying turkeys, and I'll teach you how. Then, Serendipity chef Chris DeBar and Lee Stafford, founder of the NOLA Locavore Movement, explore what the pilgrims might have eaten if they landed at Port Fouchon instead of Plymouth Rock. And Professor Lance Hill is here to discuss Louisiana's favorite holiday side dish, the melaton. Prepare for a feast on this week's Louisiana Eats. One of the most magical words in the culinary dictionary is roast. Roasting virtually any food results in a delicious concentration of flavor that accentuates the virtues of a once raw ingredient. Cooking teacher and author Molly Stevens is an expert on this topic and talked with us recently to discuss her latest book, All About Roasting. In your kitchen, Molly, what are your most important roasting tools in the arsenal?
You know, that's a great question, Poppy. When I first started the book, I thought I was going to go out and buy all these fancy all-clad roasters and, you know, all this heavy-duty roasting pans. And the pans that I use the most are my, just the little baking sheet with the rim on it. That's my workhorse roasting pan for vegetables, for pieces of poultry, for seafood. I love skillet as well, a heavy skillet. And yes, I use roasting pans, but the thing about roasting is about having as much of that hot oven air circulating around the food. So if you have one of those big old Thanksgiving turkey roasting pans, the sides are like sometimes 4 inches, 5 inches high.
Oh, that's
and if
true.
You just have a little tiny chicken thigh that's only about an inch and a half, that oven air is not going to hit it. So the lower the side of the pan for everyday roasting, the better. Sure, it's great to have a big roasting pan for when you're doing a prime rib or a pork shoulder or something big and hefty that's going to sit up high in the oven. But I love just baking sheets and skillets.
Molly, for some reason, I rarely see Gulf seafood served roasted on a menu. Why do you think people are overlooking that? And do you have some suggestions for us?
Yeah, that, well, you would know better than I about why it's being overlooked. But just for myself, being down in Louisiana and eating out, it's, you know, it's about boiling. It's about that's what we do. And so it's a tradition. Plus, roasting in a hot weather climate is, I mean, I'm from the Northeast, and we roast because the oven heats up our home, too. So there are some cultural reasons. But having said that, you know, now it's, what is it, 2012 or something, and you could turn on an air conditioner and turn on an oven and have an amazing dish that comes out of roasting seafood because it concentrates the flavors. I think of it as the most simple, direct, almost honest way. You get amazing textures and flavors from doing it. So I love to roast seafood, and I roast shrimp, I roast oysters, anything, little, big. You roast whole fish. It's incredible, and you get it's similar to grilling in terms of the results you get. You mm-hmm. get these brown, caramelized exteriors and crispy end bits and tender inside. So I really encourage people, even if it's not kind of your tradition to roast it, it's sure a great way to prepare seafood.
And I would think that even down here with the heat, we tend to use our barbecue pits all the time. Yeah. You could roast on the barbecue, couldn't you?
You can. You can. Anytime. Just any closed oven, which you could make. Yep.
Would you give me an idea of how you would roast a whole fish?
Again, it depends on the size. The bigger it is, the lower the temperature. But fish, unlike meat, you're not worried about it being tough, so it doesn't have to like go super slow to tenderize. You just want it to be cooked so that the outside doesn't get overdone before the inside is cooked. But I'll clean the fish. I like to put maybe some herbs, a little citrus inside it. I love to lay the fish on a bed of herbs, so or branches of some sort, you know, something flavorful like rosemary herbs or something like that. A little olive oil on top of it, and then I put pretty deep gashes into the flesh of it so that the heat can penetrate. And then just flip it halfway through, turn it gently halfway through. And then what I love to do with seafood is finish it with some sort of maybe a vinaigrette or a relish. In the book, I've got a whole index of different kinds, like a celery leaf salsa verde, or maybe a Meyer lemon vinaigrette, or cilantro and mint, or just something fresh to put on at the end of it, or even just a squeeze of lemon, but just something fresh to finish it.
You actually include a lot of restaurant technique secrets in the book, like your duck secret.
Yeah. this is the very slow roasted duck, and I learned this from a chef in Boston, and I think we can learn a lot from chefs, but it's important to interpret them and make them work for us at home. And I look for tips that make things easier, not more complicated. So this is a 5-hour roast duck, so it's really tender and richly flavored. And when you go to cut it up, it's hot. It's hard to cut up a hot duck and have it carve it nicely, and because it's hot and it's slippery. And so one thing you could do is cook it ahead of time, and then when it's time to eat, it's cooled off, cut it up into serving portions very neatly, because it's easy to handle and nobody's looking, and you cut it up in neat little serving portions, put those back onto a baking sheet and heat them in a really hot oven.
Fire them. There's that restaurant
technique.
That's
what we say. Fire a duck for table 67. And just fire it out, or heat it up until it's cooked through, and then it gets this wonderful crackling crust on it too.
You even include a section on roasted desserts.
Well, yeah.
Let's explore that topic a little bit.
Yeah. It's in the back of the vegetable chapter, the second half, I should say, of the vegetable chapter, roasted fruits. And what happens when you roast a fruit is the sugars just get concentrated and sweeter and sweeter. So, for example, there's a recipe for roasted pineapple. I think it's brown sugar roasted pineapple. And it's basically an upside-down cake without the cake. And you get this incredible concentration of sugars. They're roasted grapes, they're roasted cherries, roasted plums. And the thing about, yes, they're desserts, but I find roasted fruits can sort of go either way. They can work themselves into the savory realm. So, for example, the roasted cherries are delicious with a creamy polenta. I don't know, maybe Poppy, you would agree, but we're seeing sweet come back into a lot of our savory, just as we're seeing savory into our sweets. And so roasted fruits play into that.
What about vegetables?
Oh, yeah. Roasted. You know, we think about roasting meat and poultry and the sort of, and the book has all the iconic, the Thanksgiving turkey and the prime rib and all those. But the roast vegetable chapter, that threatened to just take over the whole book. At one point, I thought I should just do roasted vegetables because they are so, so good. Broccoli, snap peas, green beans, onions, tomatoes, you name it. In the vegetable kingdom, you can roast it.
It's so easy and so delicious.
So delicious, yeah.
Well, thank you, Molly. Thanks for coming to talk with us.
Thanks, Poppy. It was a pleasure.
Molly Stevens in her new book, All About Roasting. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero was a young, newlywed member of Baton Rouge's Junior League when she contributed a cheesy, creamy spinach recipe to the original 1959 edition of the now classic River Road Recipes Cookbook. Like many delicious inventions, the recipe came together almost by accident.
I was serving my two-table bridge club for lunch, and I made a cream spinach, and I had this jalapeno cheese I had bought, and I just wanted to use it for something, so just on a fluke, I decided to put it in the cream spinach. And just at that time, the Junior League decided to publish a cookbook. And we were required to turn in three recipes. So spinach was the only thing that I had really created. I didn't consider myself a fine cook. I had been off to school for 7 years before I got married and actually had to ask my mother the day before the wedding, how do you make coffee?
However, the name she gave her spinach dish was no accident at all.
I have a philosophy that a name for a dish is very important, and they all have a certain rhythm to the title. Look at shrimp remoulade, oysters Rockefeller, Caesar salad, steak Diane. They all have this little rhythm to them. But anyway, I was looking for a name for my spinach and came across a recipe in a French cookbook that I have for a veal madeleine. So I said to myself, why not to spinach Madeleine?
Our hero is still incredulous over her dish's popularity.
I'm totally surprised. And the fact that it has now been 52 years since that book came out and it has been reproduced I don't know how many times amazes me.
So if it's just not Thanksgiving at your house without creamy, cheesy spinach Madeleine on the menu, you have Mrs. Madeleine Wright of St. Francisville to thank. That's why Mrs. Wright is our Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Thank you, Mrs. Wright. Your spinach Madeleine is classic holiday Louisiana Eats. Short break, we'll travel back in time, back to the Pilgrim's time, that is, and explore what that first Thanksgiving might have looked like if it had only taken place in Louisiana. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Serendipity chef Chris DeBar and NOLA Locavore founder Lee Stafford recently embarked on a journey of discovery to uncover what the Pilgrims' Thanksgiving might have been like if they landed in Louisiana instead of Massachusetts. Lee and Chris, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you, Poppy.
Yeah, thanks, Poppy. Thanks for having us on.
Lee, now you began this research. How did you go about deciding what foods might have been on that table?
We really started from scratch. We didn't have a lot of research when we started doing the research, so we used Google for the beginning of it. And we would just type in what did the native Louisianians eat and what was native to this area and the Gulf Coast and then Choctaw tribes. So that was our start. And then we got more and more leads, and we have some great interns from the Tulane Center for Public Service.
I was going to mention your interns because anybody would be envious of that good intern help you've got.
They came through, and they really enjoyed doing it. They spent a lot of time at the research, and they would call often and say, Lee, we've got these great tips. Guess what we've learned and found out?
Well, that's great. So what did they learn and find out? What were some of the things that surprised you?
What were some of the things that we were throwing around?
Mayhaws, squashes of all kinds. Basically, the three sisters were all here in various guises. Certain kinds of beans, certain kinds of pumpkins, and of course, corn. You know, it was all. So those are the three sisters, and you hear about them a lot in gardening terms, but I have a friend who's a farmer, and so they talk about the three sisters and how they grow together a lot, pumpkin, gourds, corn, and beans, but people don't often cook with them all together, so we decided immediately, well, we'll make a stew. And so we call it the Three Sisters Stew. It's something that makes sense. We're using black beans, hominy, which is a little more old-fashioned, a little more toothsome than just regular corn, and squash, and then we make a pumpkin mole to go over the top. So it's actually all vegan, but don't tell anyone in case they, you know, think they're...
In case that frightens them?
Yeah, but it's got a little chili heat, too, which is also... Chilies are a Native American plant, you know. All of those elements in the dish, whether they are locavore here, certainly are pre-Columbian foods, which, you know, a lot of people just forget that until the age of exploration... Your European ancestors and even your African ancestors had no access to corn, squash, and beans.
Yeah.
So what and chilies. So
and they were quite suspect of those things too, some of them, I think.
Some were, some weren't. Chili peppers really rampaged around the globe immediately. That was like the internet. During that age of exploration, chili peppers were adopted by every cuisine that they encountered all over the world.
You know, another thing about that Three Sisters bit. It's my understanding, and I think I've seen this done in some garden, farm garden recreations. Isn't part of the way that that symbiotic relationship works is because the corn itself provides like poles for the beans?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a growing pattern thing. Either.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a beautiful
it's
symbiotic.
Agricultural.
Yeah. So naturally, they should be eating together, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, Chris, you are such a thoughtful chef. Everything you cook, you can see all that thinking on the plate. And once Lee got the ball rolling, then you continued the research. And I understand that the Ursuline nuns figured into the picture.
Well, in a sense, the Ursuline nuns were the pilgrims. I mean, they were, you know, young women who came penniless or sponsored to come to New Orleans. And
in 1727.
Right. So they were our pilgrims, you know. So when you look at what they were eating, you start to see a picture of the early food traditions. And it's interesting how much of that resonates with us today.
And there's actually a record of that, isn't there?
I mean, there are some letters that were written by a nun.
Madeline Hichard was her name.
Yeah.
She was actually, I think, a novice. She wasn't even a fully professed sister, but that's my Ursuline history showing.
Yeah, and so she's writing to her father about what they hunted, what they ate, you know, how they were using rice flour, which actually inspired us to do something just on the idea of, well, if they had rice that early on, what if we took rice and we ground it and we made grits? So
You made your own rice grits.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
How'd you do that?
We had a beer grinder, like you would do to homebrew, because when you're making beer, you don't want to just put like whole barley and whole hops in, especially hops. They're pretty dense. So you tend to grind them, and that makes it express into the beer or the wort a little bit better. So we just looked at that, and we're like, let's see if we can make rice into grits. They'll be white. They'll look like grits. They'll cook kind of like grits. And we just did it. Because we could.
Describe the flavor profile of that.
Well, they're sandy and coarsely textured. Lee ate them, so he can also pitch in on that.
What did they taste
like? Yeah, they're
like,
very smooth. They melt in your mouth. They're creamy.
Yeah, they're creamy, and we did them with turkey necks.
Turkey necks. Now, what did you do with the turkey necks?
So, turkey necks and grits. That's a classic. So we wanted to kind of mess with your mind and think about how we could make the very best. So I braised off the turkey necks in a little marsala. And then we had some black truffles.
Ooh.
And then we had grits, but they were made out of rice. So they had all that nice aromatics, but they were white they look like grits, but then when you eat them, it starts messing with your mind. You're thinking grits, but they taste like aromatic rice. So it's a little bit of a fun thing to do, you know, to kind of put two ideas out there at once. I call that the photonic cooking, you know, where it's, is it a wave? Is it a particle? Is it what I think it is? Or is it a story behind it that I can't quite pin down? It's two things at once. And that's really the source of imagination when you're a chef, is you want to cause people to kind of stop and evaluate what's in their spoon or in their fork and just think about the passion, the story that goes on to it. Once you stop and appreciate, then that opens your mind to real pleasure at the table.
Okay, so now we know about the turkey necks and the rice grits. Walk us through the rest of the menu. What would the Louisiana pilgrims have eaten?
Well, seafood is what we started off with. We did a Johnny cake, which is an old-fashioned cornbread thing that you can make that Jamie Shannon and I did many years ago at Commander's Palace.
I forgot you worked with Jamie at Commander's.
Oh, yeah. God bless him. I miss him every day.
Yeah.
Second course was the Three Sisters stew. So again, the hominy, the black beans, the squash, the pumpkin mole. The next course was a beautiful fish dish, the old-fashioned cocktail. So it's a Meunière sauce with all the components of the old-fashioned bourbon cocktail.
Oh, I bet those Ursuline nuns wished they'd be having an old-fashioned cocktail some of those days back then in 1727.
Yeah, they were probably, hopefully, if they're lucky, had some imported Armagnac back then.
And you turned this into a Meunière?
Yeah, so brown butter sauce, so the little whisper of Luxardo cherry, some orange, laced with bitters, and we put it over oyster dressing. Then the turkey necks, and then finally for dessert, we wanted to get some persimmons. They were just barely out of season, or we couldn't quite find what we wanted to do with that, which is a little frustrating, but we made a blackberry Creole cream cheese tart, a crostata with a cornmeal crust, and then we dried some corn and made it like little jewels, and we scattered that little sweet corn inside of this blackberry tart that was cooked with port wine.
So what were some of the reactions that people had to this dinner and the food that was presented?
You know, we pride ourselves on causing trouble and wreaking a little havoc in people's minds and bellies and kind of getting, it's a holiday season, so you want to affect people spiritually with this kind of food. And I think people enjoyed the whimsy that we had, the little sense of the unexpected, and I think they also learned a little something. So that's really cool.
Lee, what were some of the big surprises?
When we started doing our research, it was interesting to learn that there is an entire culture of people out there that are researching indigenous foods. And there are websites and organizations all about the Native American Indian diet. And one of the things that I found was particularly interesting was acorn flour. And acorns are something that we've been stepping on every day since we were kids.
I kind of thought they were poison or something. I didn't realize you could eat them.
I would have thought so, too. I think we were told not to eat them when we were kids, when we pulled them out of our mouths.
It was just for the squirrels.
Just for the squirrels. But the indigenous peoples knew how to prepare these acorns, and they soaked them. They had to wash them and then dry them and wash them and dry them. And you can buy acorn flour online today. Acorn flour is a substitute for wheat flour, and it has certain properties that are good for you. And and it's not crazy to think of eating acorns.
Were there anything else, things that you wanted to use that were just inaccessible?
You always have to make aesthetic choices. You know, you can't serve people a 20-course meal of every possible thing, you know. So acorn flour is another, chestnuts, which are really a beautiful part of the American landscape, and then the big chestnut blight hit. And now, for some reason, people more associate chestnuts with Europe than they do America. But the real American chestnut was a great heritage and a symbol of this nation for a long time. We've done a chestnut and duck tagliatelle before. We just got caught in a decision of, well, can we do both? We want to do the Chappapila ducks because that's really cool that there are ducks being made in Louisiana.
Grown right here.
Yep. Like I say, if I'd given you turkey necks and duck, you might have exploded. You
or
know?
You might have started quacking on the way out the door.
Yeah.
Well, I just really want to thank both of you all for collaborating to bring us all of this Louisiana Pilgrim Thanksgiving inspiration. So happy Thanksgiving to you both, and thanks so much.
Thank you, Poppy. Thanks for introducing us and making this happen.
Yeah, that you were really the magnetizer of this to put us together in our wanton ways to celebrate all the spiritual and Thanksgiving traditions that make Louisiana such a fun place to live and eat.
All right.
I assure you it was my pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Chef Chris DeBar and NOLA Locavore founder Lee Stafford. Recently, to cook a new Thanksgiving side dish on a local morning television show, I looked back into history to see what my new collaborator, Madame Begay, might suggest. In her original cookbook, first printed in 1900, Madame's rice with eggplant and ham sounded like a perfect dressing for the Thanksgiving turkey, especially when I added shrimp to her recipe. That forward-thinking Madame Begay was a woman ahead of her time, as most dressings served today are bread-based. With so many people discovering a gluten intolerance, it's a great idea to include a gluten-free rice dressing on your holiday table. Combine diced ham with chopped onions and peeled cubed eggplant. Cook over a medium-high heat until the eggplant breaks down to an almost gravy-like consistency. This should take about 20 minutes. Add a stick of butter along with thyme, bay leaves, fresh chopped parsley, and season with salt and pepper. Then add some shrimp. Madame Begay always parboiled her shrimp before adding them to any dish, and I've discovered that her technique helps the shrimp retain their bright pink color and toothsome texture. Stir already cooked rice into the eggplant mixture, heat thoroughly, and serve. You can always make this a day in advance and reheat it just before serving time. That gives you extra time Thanksgiving morning and also allows the flavors to mix and marry. You can find this recipe on our Louisiana Eats website, Louisiana Eats at wwno.org. Have a great Thanksgiving. With regards from me and Madame Begay. Dr. Lance Hill, Executive Director of the Southern Institute for Education and Research at Tulane University, is a crop conservationist, a food folklorist, and founder of the Adopt a Melaton Project. Fall is melaton time in New Orleans, and Lance is joining us to explain what makes our local melatons so special and so endangered. Lance, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Poppy, I'm glad to be here.
So tell us, what is the difference between a Louisiana-grown melaton and the chayotes that you find so readily available in the grocery?
Well, chayote and melaton are simply two different words for this vegetable and or fruit. There are about 300 or 400 names for it around the world. However, what we find in the stores are imported varieties from Costa Rica, Mexico, and Argentina. And the like. And probably the biggest difference between what we would call a local or an heirloom melaton is the ones that are imported are actually hybridized for what the industry calls for insipid flavor. They want a melaton, and you'll see this in a store, that's smooth, is not troughed, doesn't have prickles, is uniform in size, shape, and color, and has no flavor. And if you bite into a traditional heirloom melaton, you'll discover that melatons have, some of them have tremendous flavor. So The difference is in what we call the morphology of the fruit.
Is the melaton native to Louisiana?
No, it's not native. First of all, if we look at the word melaton, the only other place that the word melaton is used to describe this vegetable is in Haiti, in what was called Saint-Domingue. Second is that in research, I've tracked it back to references as early as 1840, being grown in Louisiana and referred to as a melaton. My theory is that in 1804, there was a revolution on the island of Haiti, and about 5,000 of the Creoles of color had to flee the island and came to New Orleans and settled in what we now know as Treme. My theory is that they probably brought with them the traditional cuisine of the melaton.
So how did you become so involved with the melaton?
Well, I often say that pecans make neighbors hate neighbors, and melatons make neighbors love neighbors. But my neighbor had a melaton vine, and I never had seen one. I was from Kansas 30 years ago. And, of course, it produced about 150 melatons, and there's nothing like abundance to make people generous. And so neighbors who never talk to neighbors show up at your front door with a sack of 50 melatons and say, "Do you want them?" And so I tried them. I got their recipe for melaton pie, which was really a great way to start with melatons because it was sweet like a banana bread. And my neighbor showed me how to plant it, and that's how I became a melaton grower.
Now, you have done the research that shows that our local melaton really is endangered. Tell us how you came to discover this and about your solution to the problem, adopt a melaton.
The problem is that we didn't have imported melatons until about 15 or 20 years ago. Our role was to identify traditionally grown melatons, and we're at about 9 at this point that we think are have been grown here long enough, 100 to 150 years, to be considered an heirloom. So what we're really doing is reseeding the area so it's not susceptible to extinction.
So if someone wants to adopt a melaton, what should they do?
They can simply email us, email me at melatons, spelled M-I-R-L-I-T-O-N-S, at marketumbrella.org, marketumbrella.org. If you just Google, I think you can find the website, and just say to be added to the list. And as the heirlooms are made available, if they're available for free, or if a nursery has heirlooms that they're selling, then we notify people.
Let's go back to the taste. Is there a way that you could actually describe the taste of the local melaton?
Well, it's hard to describe the flavor of a melaton. It doesn't fit neatly, but I use the term crystalline. Crystalline is often used to define wines. But a cucumber certainly has a flavor. It's not sweet. It's not sour. It's sort of indescribable. And because a cucumber is in the same family, the cucurbit family, as the melaton, they tend to have this kind of crisp, light flavor that tends to complement certain kinds of flavors, to complement limes or in heavier sauces. It's just a question of how intense the flavor is, and also the texture can be different depending on the melaton.
I know that you have been doing research on the international ways that people consume melatons, and you've been collecting these recipes. Give us some examples of what you've uncovered there.
Well, you know, what's really fun is that with Google Translate, there are about 80 languages it translates, and you can find on Wikipedia a list of all of the names of melatons, including the Chinese character. So I put in the word sayote, which is the Philippine word, did a search, and then just translate the page, and you find a lot of recipes for the way melatons are used in the Philippines, which is an integral part of the cuisine. And that's actually where I found a recipe for melaton French fries, which is really a kind of parboiled melaton that's cut up like fries and parboiled and then fried in tempura, which is absolutely fantastic. A Réunion Island in the Seychelles, the melaton is actually worshipped on that island. It helped the runaway slaves escape into the mountains. They just took melatons with them. In Latin America, they eat the tubers, the roots, which can grow to 10 or 20 pounds and can be harvested. In the Philippines, they make a candy out of melatons. There are literally hundreds of recipes, and you can make Melaton wine. We actually have found a vintner locally here who is willing to make us 40 gallons of Melaton wine, but that's a lot of Melaton juice.
Well, I'm coming to that party, you hear? Lance, thank you for all you are doing for Louisiana's favorite food, the Melaton.
Happy to have an opportunity to talk about him.
Dr. Lance Hill, the champion of Louisiana's Melaton.
I said I ain't no funk like the Louisiana funk band. Well,
during the next short break, get ready for your turkey frying lesson. I'll be right back with everything you need to know. The bonus, frying your turkey frees your oven up for all those delicious sides. We'll be right back.
Open up your nose. It's the kind of funk. Get all up in your clothes. Funk from the city. Funk from the bayou too. Funk from the swamp down. It'll make you.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Roast a turkey again in this lifetime. And it's my bet, once you fry your first turkey, your bird will never be relegated to the oven again. But to accomplish this safely, it does take some know-how. Turkey frying must be done outdoors, not on wooden decks or in garages. Set up your burner on a concrete surface, like a patio or a driveway, and make that a safe distance from any structures. Your turkey should weigh 12 to 18 pounds and be completely defrosted with all innards removed. Most turkey frying pots will hold about 3 gallons of oil, but to be super safe, first determine the correct amount by placing the bird in the cold, empty pot and filling the pot with water until the turkey is just submerged. Then mark that water level in your pot. Now that the bird has had his bath, send him back to the kitchen to be thoroughly dried and injected. Dry the pot thoroughly, too, because moisture is the culprit in many frying eruptions. Then, fill the dry pot with oil. Meanwhile, have your injection liquid prepared, and make your own, for goodness sake. Those pre-made injection liquids offered in groceries are filled with chemicals and preservatives. I combine melted butter with orange juice, Leanperin, hot sauce, Peychaud bitters, and then I complete the cocktail with bourbon. Inject this deliciousness into the legs, thighs, and breast of the turkey. Turkey frying rigs come with a platform and stabilizing rod for lowering the bird into the oil. You'll also need a frying thermometer to be sure the oil is heated to 350 degrees. Once you begin heating the oil, never leave it unattended. And when you're ready to fry, turn the fire off until the bird is in the pot. For total safety, use a broomstick for leverage and to keep a safe distance as you suspend that turkey rig over the pot. Make it a two-man operation to slowly lower the bird into the oil. Turn the fire back on and set the timer. A fried turkey cooks 3 minutes to the pound, so depending on the weight of your bird, it'll be done in as little as 30 to 40 minutes. Turn the fire off before removing the turkey from that oil. Then, let it rest for 15 or 20 minutes on paper towel-covered newspaper to absorb any excess oil. When you cut into that fried turkey, you'll discover the most flavorful, moist meat you've ever eaten. We've posted a copy of the frying instructions and my recipe for the injection marinade on our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org. Gobble, gobble, and happy Thanksgiving from me and all your friends here at Louisiana Eats. Although obsessed with baking since she was a little girl, pie became a passion for Seattle's Kate McDermott in 2005 when she began a 2-year exploration of pie crust. In 2010, Seattle Magazine named Kate Food Rockstar of the Year. Kate's mission is to make the world better, one pie at a time. At this time of year, when most people's thoughts turn to pie, we're turning to Kate for pie-making advice. Kate, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Well, thank you, Poppy. I'm just tickled to be here.
So tell me, what do you think the biggest secret to pie-making really is?
There's nothing that is hard about pie. In fact, those words, easy as pie, they really do have some truth in them. I think the biggest thing is just to believe that you can do it, not to worry about a perfect outcome, because in those little places where you have a little tear here in the crust, or you have a little, it didn't look quite like the pictures in the book, you have beauty and perfection right there in that pie.
And good taste, too, I imagine.
And memories.
Well, start us off from scratch. How do you make a pie?
I'd love to tell you that. First thing I do is I want to make sure that all my ingredients are chilled, as many as possible. So I am putting my flour in the freezer. I'm keeping my fats well chilled. My bowl comes out of the freezer, too. Then I have a very, very simple recipe. It's got 4 ingredients for the dough. There's flour, 2.5 cups. There's salt, 1/2 teaspoon. There's the fats. I use leaf lard, 8 tablespoons of that, and 8 tablespoons of butter, and enough water to put it all together. Now, when I'm working with those fats and moving them into the flour, I'm working very, very quickly. I can do this either with my hands and just sort of smoosh that fat right into the flour until it looks like it's sort of coated with cracker crumbs, peas, almonds, and maybe a small walnut meat or pecan if you like that. Then I will get the water in until it's mixed enough to hold together without being sticky. And when I pull it into a ball that's about the softball size, you kind of feel, you know you're there if you can feel like you're going to pat a baby's bottom.
Well, tell me, what is leaf lard?
Leaf lard is the rendered fat from around the pig's kidneys. For generations, it is what pie makers have used for the flakiest crusts around.
Where do you get leaf lard from?
I have several places that I get it. I'm using so much leaf lard in my classes monthly. I go through 50 pounds of leaf lard in a month.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm teaching a lot. So I get it from a place in Pennsylvania, Dietrich's Meats and Country Store, and you'll love where they're in, Crumbsville, Pennsylvania.
Well, that's perfect for pie making. I'm going to have to do some research to find out where our listeners can find leaf lard. Kate, what do you do if the pie doesn't work out?
Uh-huh. That's happened to every pie maker around. First thing, you don't worry about it. And then you get out your lasagna pan and you turn that pie with its beautiful ingredients into the pan, move those pie ingredients around that's baked, and it turns into the best crumble you've ever had.
That's a perfect solution. What do you do if your guests are gluten-free?
Ah, yes. Gluten-free is a big thing now, and I myself try not to eat too much gluten, but for those who can't eat it at all, you can make a gluten-free pie that's pretty darn good. I use 7 different flours And then I just go ahead and pretty much make my dough as usual. There's a couple little tricks to it. Instead of making my dough first and chilling it, and then making my filling and then rolling out, I put my filling together first, then immediately go on to making my gluten-free dough and construct the pie, and then chill it.
Ah. What are those flours?
I use several different rice flours. I use potato starch, tapioca flour, or tapioca starch. Those are just a few of the ones that I use in there.
Well, that's really fascinating. Now, speaking of tapioca starch, this is something else that I really don't have any experience with. And you and I shopped for pie ingredients together, and I have to admit I was a little shocked when I saw the famous pie maker add a little red box of something that said instant on it really big to the shopping cart. What was that, Kate?
Well, that was a pie maker's best friend. That was quick cooking tapioca. When I have fillings, I call them the juicy fruit fillings. These would be rhubarb, pie cherries, berries, and frozen fruits. Those can get very, very wet inside of your pie. So I like to use quick cooking tapioca, which really sort of snugs things up. I don't want it standing up like a little soldier at the end, because I like to have a certain amount of ooze in my filling, but I don't want to have fruit soup. So I will put in many times some flour, a third of a cup, a quarter cup of flour, and then follow that with anywhere between a half a teaspoon to a tablespoon and a half of quick cooking tapioca. Now, there is another secret that you'll need to know when you're using quick cooking tapioca, and that is you have to get the temperature high enough for the tapioca to do its work. So if you don't see enough bubbling at the end of your bake time, and I'm not talking about rapid bubble, I'm talking about some steady, even bubbling, then you can go ahead and kick your oven up for the last 5 minutes, maybe to 425, maybe to 440, until you see that, and then you're good to go.
Some pies are sort of mounded and some pies are flat. What's the deal with that?
There are two fruits that I will mound a pie with. That will be apple and pear. And those I just mound something fierce. It's not unusual for me to have a 6.5-inch tall apple pie or pear pie. They will slump down in the cooking, and their juice stays in pretty well if you've got enough thickener in there. But with those juicy fruit pies, I like to have them a little flatter. I would like to have them about a half an inch below the rim so we don't have any disasters.
Now, I have to ask you, what's your favorite pie?
Well, my favorite pie is always the one that I'm making. But if I had only one last pie to make, it would be a peach pie. I think that there's nothing finer than a good peach pie. And I love the Cal Red or O. Henry peaches that Frog Hollow Farms grows in California. There's nothing like those peaches.
Well, someday I'm going to have to introduce you to a Louisiana Rustin peach. And then we might change your mind just
I'm ready. Anytime.
Do you have a least favorite?
Yes.
What's that?
I call it the clean the oven pie. That's the one that I think we've all had experience with at some time or the other, where you put that filling up too high in the pie and it spills over into your oven. And then you have the smoke alarm going off and the oven is just, you don't want one of those. We've all had them.
Well, Kate, thank you so much for bringing all this pie-making knowledge into the studio here at Louisiana Eats. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Poppy, and be happy and make pie.
Renowned pie baker, Kate McDermott.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Lights Egan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh and our editor, Zoe Sullivan. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.